Oscar Moore is kind of fallen in love with this chick, and so he's not available. And they said, would you fill in for him and play with the Nat Cole Trio? And I says, well, I'm under contract with a record company, so I said, I can't use my right name. So they put down Paul Leslie. And Nat says, well, I'm with Capitol, and I can't use my name, so I'll change it to Shorty Nadine. And so the two of us, we go on stage at Jazz at the Philharmonic, the very first one. And Nat and I have played together many times. And so I know Nat's playing, and he's just excellent. And so we started out with the group on the stage at about the second number in. One of us started to play cat and mouse with the other guy. And I'd play a run, then he'd play a run, and we'd switch back and forth, see if we can cut each other apart. And the audience reacts to this, and you can see them get more uptight about it. And next thing you know, they're standing on their chairs and they're screaming and they're hollering, and this turns us on. And of course, we let go with everything that we got. And it's a matter of who's going to survive out of this thing, you know? And finally, it reaches the climax where Nat takes his hat off. He's wearing a hat. He takes the hat off and he slams it on the keyboard, stands up and he bows down to me. And it was just a great affair. And it was all ad lib. And of all people, Bing Crosby heard this Jazz at the Philharmonic. He says, you got to do this on the Kraft Music Hall. And I says, it won't go there. It won't go there. I says, this is among the people that dig jazz. And it's Jazz at the Philharmonic. And this is something that just came out of thin air and can only be done one time. You can do it again. You can do it again, and it'll be great. And we did it, and it didn't go over very good. But that just shows you how earlier you were talking about Art Tatum. And I did an interview just a couple of days ago about Art Tatum. And the fellow that was interviewing me says, when was Art at his best? And I says, he was at his best when he was playing in a little joint somewhere where he didn't play something that was the length of a phonograph record and where it was all planned as to what he was going to play note by note. And when you're jamming in Newark, New Jersey, in a mortuary behind where the guy's laying on the table, and you're in a back room with a shot-down piano and a bunch of people that are listening to a cutting session with Herman Chitterson, Don Lambert, and Leo the Lion, and Art Tatum. Finally, Art says, two more beers and I'm ready to go up there. And he says, what keys are going down now? Is it F sharp and is it C and it's A? And I said, yeah, the five keys that stick. And so Art says, well, let me finish this beer and I'll go up there. And he went up there. And whatever the song he played, let's say it was I Got Rhythm, who knows what it was. Whatever the song was he played, I know what it was. It was China Boy. He played 50 choruses. Now, he's way beyond where he would normally play. He'd play a couple of choruses, and then the applause, and then that's the end of the number. But when you're on a jam session, you're there, and you get turned on, and it's completely different in this undertaking parlor we're in, okay? And I told him this story, and I says, this is where art was at its best, is where he's gone way beyond the limits of where he usually would play China Boy, and it would sound just like you would hear it if you went out and bought the record. Here is 50 choruses of this thing and everything he could think of in his mind and create, and the emotional feeling that is in that room you can never capture again. It can only happen one time. And this is the way I remember Art Tatum, is when he did things after the show. When he went on the stage and did the show, you know that in the third bar he's going to take a long run, and then with his other hand he's going to get a handkerchief out and wipe the sweat off his forehead. Now that's planned. That's planned. And the last note he plays on the piano, he's played on every one that of every that particular song, he's played every time that I've heard him play it. Well, when you hear it in a jam session with 50 choruses, you're going to hear things that you never dreamt of, or he ever dreamt of. And how they happen, sometimes they happen good. Sometimes we walk off this stage and we'll say, gee, man, at Christmas, you were playing great. And other times, well, I didn't do it so good. It's just you're ad-libbing, it's improvising, it's different. Now, even in bluegrass and even in country music, when you get up and play these things, in many cases, today especially, okay, where the guy is so influenced by others, like I was when I was a kid, that's the way it is today. The mandolin player, he can take off and play all kinds of things, okay? And so this makes the mandolin player different today. And here is this is so interesting. And that is that the songs that I'm doing on the Bluegrass album were recorded 70 years ago. And I have them in a wax container, and they're in there and never have been played. And they're only me with my guitar singing these songs, bluegrass songs, knowing that someday, 70 years later, I'm going to find the finest guitar player, the finest violinist today, and put them around me and record it with my voice 70 years ago. Isn't that going to be interesting?
It sounds really, really exciting.
So I sing these old crazy songs. He's a stern old bachelor, the Boston Burglar, Mother Put My Little Shoes Away, Tie the Leaves So They Won't Fall Down. And there are songs that you've never heard of them. You've never heard of them. And they're 70 years ago they were popular. And I'll bring those back with brand new players that are excellent players today.
And we really look forward to that. I know that we don't have a whole lot of time left, so I wanted to, jump forward a little bit. But back in 1947, after experimenting in your garage studio, you came up with a version of the song Lover for 8 electric guitars. And You played all the parts yourself, of course. Then you convinced Capitol Records to release it, and it became a hit the following year. Tell us how you produced the multi-track recording.
Well, the multi-track recording, I'll first tell you how it came about, the idea came about. And the idea came about the first time was when I poked holes in a piano roll. And I could add notes to the notes that are already punched out on the piano roll. So if I got a Fats Waller thing, and I figured I want to make that run a little different, I'll punch a hole. If it's in the wrong place, I paste some tape over it and punch a new hole. And finally got down to where I could do it, where I could punch the hole where it was right. And then the Band-Aids weren't all over the piano roll. All right. Now, later, I was playing the Oriental Theater in Chicago, and my mother came down to visit, and I was with the Andrews sisters and my jazz quartet. And what happened was very interesting. My mother said, "I heard you last night, Lester, and you sounded very good." And I said, "Mom, it couldn't have been me." I says, "I'm here at the theater playing with the Andrews sisters. It had to be somebody else." She says, "Well, he's copying you because he sounds just like you." And I said, "Well, I don't know what I can do about it. I can't copyright this thing. And if someone wants to play like me, I guess I'll just have to live with it." Well, I thought about it. And so I went to the manager of the Andrews sisters and said to Lou Levy, I said, "I'm leaving you." I says, "You can keep my trio, and I'm going out to Hollywood, and I'm going to lock myself in that garage. And in my recording studio, I'm going to develop a new style of playing that my mother can tell me from anybody else." And that's where the new sound came from. It came from my mother because she's getting me confused with others that play and sound like me. So my mother can't tell Django Reinhardt from Les Paul, from this guy, from that guy. And it's difficult. And so I wanted something that was completely different, so that when you heard the record, if you were to listen to "World's Waiting for the Sunrise" or "How High the Moon" or "Tiger Rider" or "Via Con Dios," you would say, "That's Les Paul and Mary Ford." Is because of the very different sound. Okay, and with all the multis that you can do in recording, there's 37 different guitars on one of my recordings. Okay, and here they all a guitar, but I can make that guitar sound like a viola, like an organ, like a cello. Okay, somewhat like it. Okay, enough that if you go out If you listen to the record Goofus, you'll be surprised to hear that that's a guitar. And it's and the guitar sound on that recording sounds exactly like a marimba. And you say, oh, don't tell me that's a marimba. And when you hear it, you'll say, those are drums. And they're not drums. They're beating, me beating the guitar, beating on the neck of the guitar.
You mentioned Mary Ford. And, of course, you know, how why did you guys start working together? But also, how did you choose the tunes that Mary recorded?
The way it started is I took Mary and myself, and we drove from L.A. to Wisconsin because I wanted my family to meet the girl that I was going to marry. And I wanted them to know each other, and we were going to get married there in Milwaukee, which I did, which Mary and I did. We got married there. And the next idea was is that the first song was in my dad's basement. Okay, and we were to do together, and that was Sentimental Journey. Was the very first song that we recorded in the basement, and I said, "This is without a doubt the girl I'm looking for." And so I went to Capitol Records and asked Capitol Records if they would change the contract. Instead of it reading Les Paul, and the agreement was with Les Paul, that it would say Les Paul and Mary Ford and make it a team. And their argument, Capitol's argument, was is the way you got it now, it's Les Paul and whoever he wishes, which means that I can put a trumpet in there, I can use Joe Venuti, I can use Benny Goodman, I can use everybody. But you can't do that if you're going to go the other direction, and it's Les Paul and Mary Ford. Now you have to rewrite the whole contract. I says, I believe, this is the way I believe, that if I make all instrumentals, that the people are going to tire of it. And in many cases, you would like to hear the vocal. And the vocal is very important. And so I says, I want someone that can sing, that, and the voice has to be someone that matches my guitar playing. And so I had three people in mind, Doris Day, and I hired Doris Day to take to be my partner, okay? And then the last minute, we were at the Paramount Theater at the time, I sent Marty Melcher back there to tell, to deliver the news that I changed my mind, that I didn't want to see panties flying out of the back window of my station wagon. And her sitting there 15 minutes playing a tambourine while I'm out there playing Lover. So I says, this isn't going to work. I got to find someone that can play some guitar and be part of the act. And so Mary was the one I was looking for. Little did I know that the girl that I was bringing to Waukesha to get their blessings and get married would be the girl that someday would be Les Paul, Mary Ford, be the team.
I was dancing with my darling to the Tennessee waltz when an old friend I happened to see. I introduced her to my loved one, and while they were dancing, my friend stole my sweetheart from me. I remember the night and the Tennessee waltz. Now I know just how much I have lost. Yes, I lost my little darling the night they were playing the beautiful Tennessee.
Now, you also went into semi-retirement from music in the late 60s and early 70s. What were you doing in that period?
Getting drunk. That was, excuse me, but it's true. We're going through a divorce, and I said, well, I'm done playing anyway. I don't want to play no more. Mary didn't want to sing anymore. She wanted to take care of the children, and I just wanted to go do what I wanted to do. And I was busy inventing and doing all kinds of other things. And I wanted to go out and get a little jazz group and go that way. And so I think for the time being, I'll just forget about it. So for 10 years, I didn't play. And then after the heart surgery, which was a toughie, and they couldn't do the heart surgery the normal way, so they had to devise a new way. And the doctors, Dr. Loop said to me, he says, I got a way of doing this. I don't know why no one else thought of it, but I would like to do it. But that would be if you okay it. And I said, well, what are the odds? And he says, the odds are the same, that I'm going to make it. But he had a new way of bringing the mammary artery down. It's now the way of getting your bypass surgery. It has become, I was number one guinea pig for this whole new idea. And Dr. Loop takes, he deserves the credit for being the first one to do it. After I was wheeled into his office, and he was so elated that the thing not only works, but it extends your life, where the old method, which the other five people in my room all passed on, the longest that you could possibly get out of it, maybe 10, 12 years or something like that. And there may be exceptions to that, but that's generally the rule, is about 10 years. Okay, versus this new way, which could go indefinitely. And it's 27 years now since I've had my heart surgery. When I was in his office, he said, I want you to do me two favors. And I said, sure. And one, will you be my friend? And to the doctor, he tells me, and I says, of course, doc. And he says, all right. And so that was one. The other one, he says, will you promise me that you work hard? And I says, I thought that's what got me in here. No, he says, work never killed nobody. He says, this will do you good, and you'll get along much better if you work. Okay. And that's what happened, is that I came out, no drinking, no smoking, lose the weight, and you abide by all the rules of those that have a heart condition. And I went back, looked up, looked for a job, and I says, well, where was I most comfortable? And I drew a line down a sheet of paper, and I put all the negative stuff on one side and all the positive on the other. The positive was to be in a joint where there's no boss to bother you. That'll never happen, but I wished it would. And the other one is that money is no object. Money's no object. I got plenty of money, so I don't care about that. I just want to play with who I'm happy playing with when I want to play and how I want to play. If I want to make the show 2 hours long, no one's going to tell me not to. And it's a small place and not where I lose contact with 50,000 people in a very large concert. I want to be in an intimate nightclub. So I went, I happened to be in New York, and so I started looking for a place in New York, and I found a little joint. And I went in that joint, and it got jammed.
Fat Tuesdays?
Yeah, Fat Tuesdays. And when I left Fat Tuesdays, I went in there for ulcers because of the arthritis and the medication. And when the ulcers are gone, I said, I'm going back to work again. So I go to the old Iridium and then here to the new Iridium. And the place, you can't get in. You have 2 months wait to get in. So they're booked way, way 2 months in advance. And so yeah, I'm very happy and very lucky.
One, two, three, four.
I don't know who's responsible, but it's a guy up there, and it sure ain't me. Because all I'm doing is what the doctor told me to do, and I love to work. I love to do what I do. I love to play, love music, and don't drink, don't smoke, and lost my weight. And I feel great. So that's the answer to that. For your listeners, and that would be that if you have any interest in playing an instrument or doing anything like I'm doing, where you love your work, the thing to do is make sure that you're qualified. And if you, say for instance, if you play the guitar, first thing to find out is that you got a good ear, and the second thing is that you got good rhythm. Because you can't buy it in a music store. And the third thing is determination and hard work. And just realize that this is a never-ending thing and it'll keep you young. So that's my advice.
You've been listening to an interview with legendary guitar player Les Paul, recorded at the Iridium Jazz Club in New York City on April 7th, 2008. Special thanks to Jim Igo and Michael Bronstein for making the interview with Les Paul possible. Thanks to Ali Lexa, Mark Lindahl, Mark Torres, Jerry O, and Casey Hodges at Gibson Guitars for all your support and much-needed assistance regarding this project. And last but certainly not least, my sincere thanks to Mr. Les Paul for his graciousness, generosity, and wonderfully candid comments. Les Paul's prolific and amazingly productive career for well over 70 years is absolutely remarkable. His contributions in so many distinct areas of American pop culture makes him a true American icon. How fortunate I am to have spent that time with him. My interview with him is truly one of my most memorable experiences of all time. It has been a pleasure to share it with you.